Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Sam and Sadie, they aren't spouses, and he's not her child. And yet this is the most important relationship that both of them have.
Gabrielle Zevin joins us to talk about her new novel, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which takes us inside the world of video game design through the lives of three characters.
You know, I was very much aware that Indigenous fiction tries to perform for a largely white readership, and I always wanted to shy away from it.
Morgan Talty is here to talk about his debut story collection, Night of the Living Res. Plus, my colleague Liz Harris will be here with news from the publishing world, and the Times' critics Dwight Garner and Alexandra Jacobs will be here to talk about books they've recently reviewed. This is the Book Review Podcast. It's July 1st. I'm John Williams. Gabrielle Zevin is the author of several novels, including The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey. Her new book is Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, and she's here to talk about it. Hi, Gabrielle.
Hi.
So let's start with the title, because that is a very notable line from literary history. How did you decide on it, and was that first?
It was not first. It came about, I would say, 25% of the way through the process. The funny thing is that the publisher, the big debate was whether to leave the commas in or not. They're like, will it be searchable if there's commas after each of those tomorrows?
But you did not include them.
We did include them.
Oh, you did.
This is Knopf. We included them. You know, the precision of the comma. And Shakespeare includes them, by the way. So I think that was the argument that went out in the end.
This is a famous line from Macbeth. And how does it play into the idea of your novel?
Well, it's probably one of the bleakest speeches in all of Shakespeare. And it's the first bit of Shakespeare that I ever committed to memory. And I can still do it on command if I'm ever asked. Not that I'm ever asked, but if asked, I could do it. And it is one of the bleakest speeches in all of Shakespeare, but the character who invokes it in my novel finds great hope in it. The idea that every day we're alive is a chance to start again. And he also, conveniently for my novel, which is about video games, finds a metaphor for video games with their infinite lives and infinite chances at redemption. I always feel like I want to say about the title that when it comes up in the book, the character who is invoking it, who's Marx, he is trying to sell people on the idea of Tomorrow Games as the name of their company. And so he proposes this argument about why this is not a bleak speech. So there's a bit of irony to it as it appears in the book.
Revising Shakespeare is a bold move. So I'm glad we started there to give people a sense of the ambition of this book. And now let's step back a bit, because it is a book with a lot going on in it. But let's give a sort of bare bones thumbnail sketch of the three main characters and their relationship to each other.
The three main characters are Sadie Green, Sam Mazur, and Marx Watanabe. And Sadie Green is a girl from Los Angeles who, as a child, her sister has childhood leukemia, and this provides the greatest trauma of her young life and probably her interest in video games, I would say. So she's a game designer. Sam Mazur is her game design partner. He also has a childhood event that leads to an injury. He's a half Korean and half Jewish, which I am as well. So he's probably the closest character I've ever written to myself. And he is a person who, like me, feels in between two cultures. To be Korean and to be Jewish is to be neither of those things fully. And I think that's one of the many things Sam faces in the book.
I'm going to pause there because before we get to Marx, because there's already a lot I want to ask about and establish for people. So Sadie and Sam, you say that they're game design partners. How old are they when this is happening? They're pretty young, right?
Yeah, it's a Künstler Roman, essentially, you know, which is the coming of age of an artist. And that's how I saw the story as I was working on it. It follows them from about the age of 10 to the age of 34, something like that. It's about 30 years. So they are young the whole time. But by the time they're at the end of the book, I don't think they feel young anymore. At the end of the book is kind of the beginning of middle age for them.
Let's talk about that first scene when they re-meet. They're in a subway station in Boston, and maybe that's a good way to say where they are in their lives at this point. They've already met years ago, but now they're re-meeting, and what happens after that?
They had had a conflict as children. They'd been kind of childhood best friends. And then they run into each other again in this train station in Cambridge. And they, sorry, I just did that thing. You said Boston, I said Cambridge. But in fact, it is Cambridge. So they meet at this train station in Cambridge and they see each other across a train platform. And they make that decision that we all have to make at some point in life, whether to re-engage with somebody who you were once close to or whether to just keep walking. And so it all comes down to, I think, this moment. And impulsively, Sadie hands him a game she has made for her seminar at MIT, her advanced game seminar. And this begins their collaboration.
And how does that collaboration go? It's a success.
Yes, the collaboration is a huge success, but I thought a lot about artistic partnerships, both in music and in many different fields when I was writing this book. And so I think it has its ups and downs. And something I wanted to write about was how, while they do initially have the success, careers in the arts aren't really straightforward trajectories. They don't go up and up and up and up, like creatively or business-wise. And so I wanted to write about that. I said to my agent at one point that I think this is a book about failure. And he was like, can you please stop saying that? So,
yeah, not the most popular subject for people, but it isn't in a way. I want to get to Marx in a second and the role he plays. But this isn't really, not to give anything away, but it's not really a love story in the traditional way between Sam and Sadie. So what was it about that creative partnership that inspired you? And what did you want to get at in terms of their relationship with each other?
A friend of mine described the book as being what it's like to co-parent something that's not a child. I think that is a truthful description of it. Sam and Sadie, they are more intimate with each other than anyone else in their lives, yet they aren't spouses and he's not her child. And yet this is the most important relationship that both of them have. So I wanted to write about that. What if the most important person in your life was really your colleague and your friend?
And I guess the follow-up question to that is, why gaming? They could have been musicians or some other creative pursuit.
Well, I hope when you read the book, you don't think they could have. Although I also hope when people read the book that they understand the ways in which gaming is really just another form of storytelling. But why gaming? I think it's interesting, at least, that the first generation of people to play video games as children were born in the late 1970s. We call that the Oregon Trail generation, and that's a microgeneration. Microgenerations are often defined by access to technology, and this particular generation is defined by the fact that they would have played the game Oregon Trail in a computer lab in school. So what interested me about that, in addition to the fact that I am a member of that generation, was how your perception of life and novels and everything else would be changed by playing games your entire life, how that phenomenologically changed your experience of life. So in the end, what I was really interested in was telling the story of the coming of age of these two characters that mirrored the coming of age of this industry. And so if you look at games from the 70s to now, what you see is something like Pong with two lines. And then what you see when the book ends in, say, 2011 are games like The Last of Us that have cinema quality graphics. And so it's really easy to see this visual evolution of tech when you look at the evolution of games. And so to me, that just seemed like a natural background and subject for novel.
You've played games your whole life. How enthusiastically and how much did that change your view of things like novels and other things in the world?
You know, it's funny. My dad was a computer programmer and both my parents were career IBMers. And so the first games I ever played were games that my dad brought home on a work PC. And they were the games that were preloaded, kind of silly little games like Alley Cat and Jumpman and things like that. And I was immediately attracted to them because they solved a very particular problem of my childhood, which was the fact that I'm an only child and had no one to play with. So before that time, if I would play, say, a board game, I would have to spend a lot of time imagining an other. Suddenly, like, this only child has someone to play with, and it's a computer. For me, that was the role they played. That said, I never thought about gaming as an interesting pursuit in the way I thought of reading novels. It was just something I did when I wasn't reading novels. And in fact, I would say I pursued gaming in a pretty haphazard way and in a thoughtless way.
Did that change at some point? Did you start pursuing it in a more thoughtful way?
I do think I started pursuing it in a more thoughtful way around the writing of this book. It had occurred to me, I had had another book come out a couple of years ago. And sometimes after you have a book come out, you feel sort of a trough of emotion. I guess we'd call that a depression, in other words. And so I found myself looking up, as I do, the games of my youth. I researched down this rabbit hole of trying to find this game called Gold Rush, which was made by this company called Sierra. And the funny thing about that was just having this small realization that games could disappear because they are tied to certain kinds of hardware, et cetera, that these games that were kind of seminal storytelling experiences for me as a kid could just no longer be there. And now these games have been ported and you can play them on a PC. A lot of things do come back. But that was a thing that hadn't occurred to me before. And it made me think how I hadn't really thought about games as literature. But in fact, they are literature.
I want to get back to that in a minute, but you write in the book, there is no artist, or one of your characters says in the book, there is no artist more empathetic than the game designer. Do you have any dabbling in tech or game design yourself, or did you talk to other designers to get a sense of some things for the book?
Well, my dad, as I mentioned, was a computer programmer. I dabbled in programming, but in the same way everybody dabbled in the 80s, a little bit of BASIC, a little bit of whatever. But I, you know, I'm not a game designer. I'm a novelist by trade. And so I think a lot of the experiences that they have come from the truth of being a novelist and being a storyteller in that form. And some of those experiences overlapped. So in fact, most of the game designing knowledge I have comes from just hard, brute research.
I've pushed aside poor Marx until this point. I promised we would get to him. His name is Marx, as in Karl Marx. Who is he and what role does he play in the book?
Yes, his name is Marx, as in Karl Marx. His father decides, I think it's like his last gesture at a life before being a true capitalist, is to name his son Marx. But in the story, he is Sam's roommate. He is kind of pursuing acting at Harvard, though I went to Harvard and there isn't actually like an acting major or anything. He's just a guy who's in a lot of plays. And he's one of those very brilliant people who are not really sure what they're going to do with their brilliance. And so when his friend Sam and his roommate decides to make a game, he decides to come along for the ride. But it turns out he's really great at doing everything that a game producer does. And for me, Marx is a character that represents all the people whose names are not on the jacket of a book, like all the people that actually help you to make art. And so he's a lot of people that I love all thrown into one character.
There's a lot of interpersonal drama in the book. There's the drama of making something and there's the drama of game design and trying to be successful with that. But there's also this triangle between them. How do they play off of each other? And what was the balance you were looking for when you were writing it?
Triangle is a fraught word.
It is.
I would say, like, I don't see it as a love triangle or anything like that, except insofar as there's never going to be an end of the story where, and I don't think this is a spoiler, but this isn't a story about romantic love. But to me, the thing that I think you could potentially miss is that his intimacy with Sam is just as great as his intimacy with Sadie. The three of them are equally intimate. It's a triangle in a true sense in that they're not competitive with each other. They all have equal ways in which they balance this triangle that holds all of this together. At first, Sadie is very dismissive of Marx. She sees him as one of these kind of rich kids. I think she calls him a rich kid with a lot of interests and very few skills, but she becomes more and more interested in him as a person as she sees what a formidable game producer he is, you know, and what a formidable creative person he is. And I think throughout the book, you definitely really see the ways in which Marx is just as creative as Sadie and Sam.
Well, I did leave the word love off a triangle intentionally, and my math... My math is very rusty, but I believe we're discussing an equilateral triangle.
It's a very equilateral triangle.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, just don't ask me to define what an isosceles triangle is. I just remember the word. Your novels all vary from each other in terms of the stories they tell. They're set in very different worlds. And I'm curious as to what you look for in the background or backdrop of a novel. Is it the world that you get to research that interests you, or is it more random than that?
Well, you know, it's changed over the years. I think when you start out as a novelist, you are just writing whatever you're able to write at that moment to an extent. And then as you go on and you hopefully acquire more craft, and in my case, even some more financial freedom because the books have done pretty well. Not all of them have done really well, but some of them done pretty well. And so I think I've gotten more selective about what I wanted to pursue as a subject. And so I think even 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have chosen to pursue a big subject like games, because a subject like games has so many things in it. But there were 5 years, I think, between this novel and my last novel. And so I felt the luxury of this time. And so the thing that I think I choose that has been consistent is I choose whatever is obsessing me at the time. Somebody asked me a question recently that was like, do you tend to write books about subjects you care about? This book seems like it has a lot of subjects you care about. Well, they all have. I don't personally want to read books from people who are writing about things they don't care about. But in fact, that's really the only measure to me. I think I'm a little bit better at recognizing what is a novel than when I started. So there's more, I think, intentionality now than there was back a decade ago. And at one point, and this is, I guess, a related or adjacent point, Sadie talks about the fact that when you start out as an artist, there's a gap between sort of your abilities and your taste. And for me, I felt that and have felt that, which isn't to say I don't like the previous novels, just that ideally in a career, you improve and you get closer to the thing that is the thing you love to begin with.
Well, I do think listeners are very interested in general in writers and their paths and how things happen. And I was watching a previous interview of yours from several years ago in which you called publishing your first novel the quote unquote great trauma of your 20s. And I don't mean to re-traumatize you, but I wonder what you meant by that and whether maybe listeners might take some comfort by what you meant from that.
It was the great trauma of my 20s. I published two novels the same year. So this is 2005, 17 years ago, my first novel for adults. And then a couple months later, a novel for young readers. The thing that people don't tell you when you publish a book is that it will forever change your relationship to books. So formerly, if you were a person who derived great comfort and pleasure from reading, which describes me, you will not feel exactly the same way about books after that. And so for me, it was a horrible trauma because, as I mentioned, I'm an only child. And so in a sense, I felt the greatest intimacy in my life with with books I've read. And then you start, again, seeing them differently. You start seeing how they look on the shelf and who gets what and all the stuff. And I will say, after many years, you do stop feeling that. At least for me, the trauma can heal.
And is this also something about how they're put together on the inside, not just the business apparatus? Is there, or is that just something that comes the first time you write a story in a spiral notebook when you're a teenager?
I will say, at this point in my career, I really love the process of writing the novel. And I love the process of working on the novel with the editor. But pretty much every other part of the process, I could leave. And so it's good to know, essentially, that that's the part I enjoy. But when you're first writing a book, frankly, even the writing of the book is very, very difficult because you're in a place where you don't understand all the things you're feeling and really even how to do it. You kind of constantly feel incompetent. So then you enter the next ring of it where you constantly feel incompetent in a new way, which is bad at like promoting, just bad at everything. And also with lots of examples all the time of how well everyone else is doing. But, you know, I feel that less and less. And that's a good thing about having that behind you. And I will say, and this is, again, a related point, but maybe not the point. You know, it's funny how much publishing is an industry that's geared up around like the great debut. And it certainly happens. And we all love it when it happens. But for me, I don't know that I wrote a great debut. I think it was the best book I could write at the time. I don't not get behind it. But I think even for people other than me, sometimes the best work is 4 or 5 novels in.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I think those arcs can look very different. There's sometimes people burn all of it in the debut and it's fantastic and they never live up to it again. And the reverse can happen.
Yeah. And I think people decide what they think about a writer from that debut. And that's really a mistake. I'm somebody who, until this book, wasn't published at a big publisher for my adult work. Originally, my first book was published at Miramax Books, which dates me already because Miramax does not exist, obviously. It was a division of Hyperion, I think. But then the others were at Grove Atlantic and Algonquin. And the reason I mentioned that is because the freedom that gave me was to pursue strange things and to really kind of figure things out. And having that creative freedom meant everything in terms of just building up. And so it's the opposite of, say, starting out with like a huge advance, which that's great too. I'm sure that's great if that works out for you.
Enjoy it.
Enjoy that. But in fact, doing everything kind of in like incremental progress has also been very valuable in terms of, you know, I use that word craft again, but really learning the craft of writing and having time to figure out who I even was as a writer.
there's so much more we could talk about specifically in the novel. I'm going to let readers discover for themselves, because it's one of these, it is a sort of bursting at the seams novel, a very traditional incident-rich human story. But I want to go back to something you said, which is that games at their best can be literature, because as someone who certainly spent a great deal of his time playing Tetris and Ms. Pac-Man back in the day, I'm not someone who has kept into gaming, and I approach that phrase with more skepticism than maybe I should. I'm curious about one game that you would say that about and explain why you think that is.
The thing about it is, I don't think they do the same things that novels do in the end. You know, I think what they do is a really unusual thing with the way they deal with point of view and the way a person can feel as if they have the illusion of agency when they're playing a game that they don't have when they are reading a novel. But it is only an illusion of agency, by the way, because there are only, in even a kind of big immersive game, there's only several storylines that you might follow. But for people playing, say, a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, those lives can take on whatever you put into them. I'm trying to think of what the equivalent is, but I think they do end up being novelistic in the ways they can iterate. But a game that I played when I was a kid was a game called King's Quest IV, which was a game made by Sierra. And, you know, in the book Hackers, there's a good section about Sierra games, if anyone is interested in that. So King's Quest IV was a notable game for me because it was the first game I really played that had a female protagonist. King's Quest 1 through 3 do not have female protagonists. The story is very reminiscent of classic literature, but the way you solve the puzzles in the story is by recognizing the reference that's being made. So sometimes there's a reference to, say, I don't know, Greek tragedy. There's things with Pandora's box in there, and you have to know, like, don't open that box because that's Pandora's box, that kind of thing. And so I remember feeling like very clever when I was playing it as a kid, because it felt like a true practical application of literature for me. But I think there are games that have the scope of novels now. So I'm thinking of something like The Last of Us, which feels quite a bit like The Road or The Passage by Justin Cronin. Games call on literature all the time. Games are so young. They're so much younger than novels. I don't think we've approached at all what that form can do. I don't love playing all games equally. I don't love shooting at things or killing things. It's just, it's not my thing. I don't love that. I don't really love gratuitous violence in books or films either. But in any case, I don't know that there's one game I can cite for you that will really make that argument.
Well, I don't want to get any angry mail sent your way anyway. So it's best not to alight on one particular game. Maybe what we're saying is that literature gives you the illusion of inhabiting another consciousness, and games give you the illusion of agency. They're both illusions.
It's all illusion.
So again, your latest string of illusions is the novel Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, about the gaming world and much more besides. Gabrielle Zevon, thank you so much for being here to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Morgan Talty's debut collection of 12 short stories is called Night of the Living Res, and he joins me to talk about it. Hi, Morgan. Thanks for being here.
Hey, John. Thank you for having me.
Tell me a bit about where you grew up and what role storytelling played in your life and community when you were young.
So I grew up on the Penobscot Indian Nation, which is in Maine. It's right near the Bangor area. I was actually born in Bridgeport, Connecticut, but I only lived there until I was six. And then my mom and I moved to Indian Island. And growing up, stories were everywhere. And they were the things that my friends and I used to sustain our days. We would tell stories of what happened to somebody when we weren't around. In school, storytelling was a large part of the learning environment. We had Native American Studies class, and John Bear Mitchell, who works at the University of Maine now, was our teacher, and he was just a phenomenal storyteller. My mom was always telling stories, although she was particularly bad at getting the details correct, which is probably where I picked up some good skills for fiction. They were very important for me growing up.
How old were you when you started to either write stories yourself or to feel like you might have the urge to write fiction?
I feel like it was second grade when I started to tell stories, and they were more orally. My teacher at the time told my mother that I had a very active imagination. And she was like, you know, he was telling the story about how he works for a moving company during the summer. Then my mom's like, well, his dad does own a moving company and he does go out on jobs. So it was kind of like I was like straddling this realm of nonfiction and fiction from a very early age. And I didn't really know that I wanted to write fiction until I was like 18 or 19. And I was like, oh, I can do something with storytelling. And I just followed my gut with it stubbornly, I think, and didn't think about anything else except writing and stories and literature.
So tell me a little bit about the central character in these stories, because they are very much linked stories that have recurring characters and they're set in the same place.
The book is told through the point of view of David, and we see David at various times in his life. I really think of this story as having two parts. There's the David narrative, or the David stories, and then there's the D stories, which are David when he's grown up. And they're interspersed throughout. So we get a D story, and then we get a David story, a D story, a David story. And they each group moves chronological in time. And we see David as a boy grow up. And in these stories, they stand alone, and they are representative of these daily trials that this family faces. And we see these characters recur, and we see them grow and develop and get older in the David stories, that is. And in the D stories, we get this sense of, okay, something happened, because there was a very bleak atmosphere to it. And a lot of the characters we see in David's stories are not really there in D's. And so there's this question of, well, what happened? And it's in the back of the reader's mind, I think. You know, I think more so, much more focus is put on the stories themselves. But we get this look at this family through David's lens in these 12 stories, what it means to basically exist as a family, you know, struggle as a family, and ultimately come back together after tragedy.
David is growing up in the same place where you grew up. What is his relationship to this community's history? How does he feel that he does or doesn't fit in?
Probably in the same way that many, and I don't mean to generalize here, but in the same way that many Indigenous people feel, there's this sense of belonging and there's this sense of not belonging. Colonization has done some real damage to Indigenous communities, obviously. That's an understatement. But when we think about communities, Indigenous communities, internalizing that colonization, you know, we think of blood quantum, for example, and Indigenous people using that as a means to say who is more Native than somebody else, right? It's just a preposterous idea.
Could you describe a little bit more about blood quantum and what that is?
So blood quantum is one way that tribes use to track membership in a community. And this is especially important for federally recognized tribes that receive federal funding. So most tribes use blood quantum, which is, it has a blood percentage of how much, quote, Native you are. So say your mom is 50% Native and your dad isn't Native at all, you would be considered a quarter. In a way, it's an act of further genocide, I think, you know, this long-running form of violence. And so when it comes to David feeling this sense of belonging and not belonging, he certainly, I think, like others, has this sense of not feeling like he's in the right place, even though he is, and at times he knows he is, especially when he's trying to return to his family in those D narratives, when he's trying to overcome what had happened in the past to be whole again.
You've talked about wanting to write in a way against some of the received images and traditions of what people think of when they think of Native American literature. are there a couple of places in the collection that you could point to as examples of that to stand in for the whole?
You know, I was very much aware that Indigenous fiction tries to perform for a white readership or a largely white readership. And there are instances in books that I've admired by Native writers that I could see this. And I always wanted to shy away from it because I didn't want to keep feeding into that type of storytelling. And I think throughout the book, there's less association with indigeneity in the characters. So it's the characters who are front and center. It's their human nature that's front and center, as opposed to maybe something cultural or something unique and specific that might give a reader a comfortable, easy tour of colorful Indian country, which is not what I wanted to do. You know, I tried to keep those two things separate and really focus on who are these characters? What do they want? What do they do to get it?
There are also moments when you do get more specific where you don't always hold the reader's hand, you know, and describe to them exactly what you mean by something that might be more insider knowledge to someone who grew up on a reservation. Is that part of that conscious choice to let people do their own finding out and not cater to them necessarily?
One of the burdens that marginalized voices have when it comes to writing fiction or nonfiction is this sense that we have to explain everything, that we have to give everything to the reader. I love literature that makes me work with the story. I think that's the type of literature that really challenges us. And so that's the type of literature I wanted to write. And so I made it, you know, my point, you know, okay, I'm not going to overtly explain things here. I'm going to let them be. And plus, we just live in an age where people read two pages and then they pick up their phone. You know what I mean? So it's like easily people can be like, oh, I'm going to look this up and find out more about this.
You are involved in teaching in an MFA program, and you have said elsewhere that you love teaching writing as much as you love writing. And that's not always true for writers who sometimes teach more out of a sense of necessity. What do you love so much about it?
I just love the writing. I've just always been drawn to how writing works, and not just in fiction, but, you know, in an essay or how any form of communication works. Communication is just such a large key of living now. People are reading and writing more than ever before in the history of humankind. And that I get to work with students who don't quite understand that yet, and I get to work with them and help them progress and become better communicators feels like a very important thing to do. It's hard. It certainly is hard, but I get so much pleasure out of reading a student essay and then talking with them and going through feedback and being like, okay, let's look at how this is working and how it's not working. Let's look at the conventions associated with this type of writing and how you're doing them, but also not doing them, right? And encouraging students to explore both their writing and their reading, because I think we need to read diversely to really be really whole people. And so it's an important part of me in my writing career, because I think without it, it might be hard to sustain some sense of humanity, some sense of like larger purpose, you know, instead of working alone at a computer all day writing.
Speaking of teachers of a sort, you've talked also about your great love of Chekhov. And I wonder if he was someone you read at a very formative age or whether you came to appreciate him later on and what you might see reflected from his work in yours.
So I encountered Chekhov when I was, I think, like 18 or 19. I was my very first mentor who I returned to his lessons time and time again. I wrote something for him and he said this reminded him of something Chekhov had written, and I had never heard of Chekhov. And so I went and I found his work and I started reading it. And I was like, oh my God, this is so good. And I've heard this said before, like I'm never going to compare my work to Chekhov's. But one of the unique things about Chekhov's stories is that they feel very unexpectedly expected. You know, there's this quote I always return to that a former mentor said, life is random, art is pattern. But Chekhov was really able to make his stories shy away from that patternness, and you kind of don't know where you're going. But then when you get there, you're like, oh, I knew I was going there all along in some sort of strange sense. And so with my work, I've always have felt that. I think maybe because I don't like structure and I don't plan, you know, I'm just sort of like, well, let's see where we end up. I think his work, reading it like subconsciously and even consciously, helped me develop how I wanted to tell stories.
We are in a moment, it feels like, and these things can be cyclical, obviously, but with the work of, I think, of Tommy Orange and Natalie Diaz, the poet, and Brandon Hobson and others, many others, and now your collection, which is getting a lot of attention, where there does seem to be a renewed focus on Native American writing. I wonder if there's a sense of that among you and your fellow Native American writers, if there's a sense of community among you, or whether you talk about that renewed moment, or whether that's just something that that's happening in the culture at large.
I think that Tommy Orange, Brandon Hobson, Therese Marie Malhot, Chelsea T. Hicks, whose story collection just came out, A Calm and Normal Heart, sense of a community in the literary community for Indigenous writers, I think is really important, because for so long, I think that there hadn't really been a community of Indigenous writers. There had been Indigenous writers, and you could list some, right? You know, Louise Erdrich and Scott Momaday, Leslie Marmon Silko, right? But I think in this age of like social media, it's made a lot of younger Indigenous writers want to collaborate and communicate. And I think there is a larger driving force for there to be more Indigenous voices, as opposed to a few that are trying to be representative of Indian country. I think we're all aware that the more voices we have in this community, the more realistic and authentic that community will become for a mainstream audience that is non-native.
Because you make the argument frequently that there are a vast number of different communities that still need to be heard from.
Exactly. You know, there's over 570 federally recognized tribes. There's tons of tribes that are not recognized. There are tons of displaced Indigenous peoples. And what happens when we start to have, you know, 100 or 200 different writers and different genres telling their Indigenous stories that are unique to them and perhaps even slightly representative of their own culture, right? Like what happens if we have, for the Penobscot Nation, for example, in 5 years, another young Penobscot person writes a novel? How does that contribute to a larger and broader understanding of what it means to be not just human, but Penobscot, right? It's the plurality of these voices that's so important.
Well, your book certainly brings us to a very particular place and into a very particular person's experience and mind. Tommy Orange said of the collection that it took me in the same way Dennis Johnson's Jesus' Son did when I first read it. And it's hard to think of higher praise than that for a short story writer. The collection, again, is Night of the Living Rez by Morgan Talty. Morgan, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much, John.
My colleague Elizabeth Harris joins me now with news from the publishing world. Hi, Liz.
Hi, John.
So start out by reminding us, what is Book Talk?
Book Talk is sort of a subsection of TikTok, which is the app where people make videos, and there's videos of people dancing and lip syncing or making cake or doing whatever they're doing. And Book Talk is like a hashtag within it where people talk about books. And a lot of it is people weeping about books they love or screaming about books that they loved so much that made them throw the book across the room. Basically, people getting really emotional about books. And it's wonderful. Or saying, if you like this book, then you'll like this book. And if you like this book, then you'll like that book. So it's basically become this place that people go to talk about books and to get book recommendations. And it's gone from being this novelty in the publishing world, where last year it started putting some books on the bestsellers and people started noticing this is actually starting to sell a real number of copies here. And it was sort of exciting and surprising. And I mean, publishers were surprised, authors were surprised, the people making the videos were surprised, but it really started to have an impact on sales. And there was always a question of, you know, how long is this going to last? Is this just sort of a thing because people are trapped in their homes because of the pandemic? But it's gone from being a novelty to being like a real anchor of sales, especially for fiction. It's fascinating because it's people just doing it because they're excited about books, and it's become a real force. Book Talk authors sold 20 million print books last year, and that section is growing 6 times faster than the rest of the adult fiction market. That's all according to BookScan, which tracks printed books in the United States.
So when you say Book Talk authors sold 20 million copies, you mean authors whose books were featured with this hashtag? Is that how they track it?
Yeah, it's sort of authors who are big on Book Talk, essentially. Yeah, like they're part of the hashtag. And certain authors like Colleen Hoover is huge on Book Talk, and she has really taken over the bestseller list this year. There have been weeks when she's had 3, 4, maybe even 5 books on the bestseller list. I know there have been weeks of 4, and it's crazy. And one of the major ways that she's gotten so big is through Book Talk. And then the kinds of books are interesting. So it's mostly fiction. It started as a lot of young adult stuff, but has now become actually mostly adult fiction. And romance is a big section of it. There's also, you know, a fair number of people in there talking about thrillers and fantasy, but also literary stuff.
can do quite well. The Song of Achilles, which came out in 2012 and is a love story between Achilles and Patroclus, has now sold 2 million copies because of Book Talk, which is amazing because, as its editor said to me, this is a book about the Iliad and it just sold 2 million copies. So,
are authors themselves going on Book Talk at all, or is this mostly readers just recommending things from enthusiasm?
It's really readers recommending things. I mean, there are authors on TikTok, there are publishers on TikTok, but the way that books really move is readers. And there are people who become influencers who have a lot of followers, but it's a little hard to know. It's a difficult platform to track, but it doesn't seem as though, you know, one person with a lot of followers recommending the book can really make a book go viral. They can put it on people's radar, but it requires a critical mass of people who are also excited about the book and all these people talking at once. And these are all everyday readers talking at once about a book they really love.
Kind of book talk, word of mouth spreading.
Exactly. And like, word of mouth has always been really important in book sales, and especially backlist sales, which are older titles, because the way books generally sell is they sell when they're new and then they plod along once they're not brand new anymore, they kind of disappear. But Book Talk is actually mostly older books, which is really interesting and very exciting for publishers.
You started the segment by describing some of the behavior and performance on Book Talk being very emotional, very enthusiastic, kind of loud. Is there a Book Talk style, or is there a lot of various ways to do this?
I think there are various ways to do this, but from what I've gathered, the most successful are the emotional ones, or the if you like this, you like this. Those are two of the standbys at this point. And it kind of makes sense if you think about it, because especially we're talking about fiction mostly here. Why do people read, right? They read because they want to go on a journey, and fundamentally people want to feel something. And this is a very efficient, direct means of saying, this is how you're going to feel. I cried, you will cry. And you know, that helps people like, oh, okay, I'll read that book.
Okay, Liz, well, I'm going to look up the hashtag. Your work here is done. I'm sure publishers are quite excited to have another tool in their box.
Absolutely. Thanks, John.
Two of my very most esteemed colleagues, the critics Dwight Garner and Alexandra Jacobs, join me now to talk about books they've recently reviewed. Hello.
Hey, John.
Hi, John.
Dwight, you got your hooks into a big biography.
Yeah, it's a new bio of Jean Rhys. It's spelled R-H-Y-S. And I mispronounced it actually for a long time before someone told me I was mispronouncing. I said Rhys, or I don't know how I said it, but I now know. And anyway, this book is called I Used to Live Here Once, The Haunted Life of Jean Rhys by Miranda Seymour. And Seymour is a well-regarded British biographer of many people.
And why now? I feel like Jean Rhys comes in and out of fashion a bit, kind of like Barbara Pym, someone we talked about on another recent episode.
You know, I don't know why now. First of all, I didn't love this book. There were two previous biographies of Rhys that I think are actually better done, one particularly much better done. And there's no real news peg for this. She's just interesting to talk about. She's one of those writers that I think will be written about a lot because her work is so interesting. Her life was kind of wild. She drank a lot. She was sort of a chorus girl back before World War I. She drank a lot. She got very cruel when she drank. She had a lot of interesting friends. There was a long period in her life. She wrote when she was young. And then for about 30 years, she vanished off the literary scene. And she came back late in her life. She was 76. And published Wide Sargasso Sea, the book that most people know of her, in 1966, when she was, as I said, she was 76, and she had come out of the blue, and people didn't even know she was alive anymore, a lot of people, and they raced back to read her earlier work. I prefer her earlier work. It's a little bit darker and bleaker and wittier, vaguely autobiographical, but not entirely.
Wide Sargasso Sea, it's interesting that she wrote it so late in life. You wonder what her reputation would have been like, or whether she would have been revived if it weren't for that book, which now is by far, I think, her best known. But that's a prequel of sorts to Jane Eyre, and so very not autobiographical, although it draws on her childhood. She grew up on a Caribbean island.
She did, Dominica, and her father was a doctor there. She got out when she was in her late teens and went to a boarding school in Cambridge and wanted to be an actress and was on the stage for a few years. And she had this sudden impulse to start writing in a journal, and those journal entries became fiction. And she had, to use a line from Orwell, a talent for telling the truth. Her stuff was just a bit more bleak and honest and lonely than a lot of writers of her period. That's why it still seems modern. I mean, I think she's just a terrific writer.
And so some of those earlier novels, you're right. I mean, they're bleak and autobiographical, even when she was
fairly young writing them. I know that her life was in some of the books that are written about her. Some of the appeal, if that's the right word, is almost a rubbernecking. There were periods of her life that could be seedy or destitute. Was she just a hard luck person, or did she bring some of this on herself?
Well, she did have a poor taste in men. Although, you know, you can argue what poor taste means. She fell for charming bounders when she was young. Two of her three husbands ended up in prison for fraud. And yet, I don't want to condemn those marriages. I mean, it's easy to say poor taste, but I think they were charming, and she had a blast with them for a long time until their bad habits caught up with them. And she also had a long, very successful marriage, her second marriage. And it's funny, as one of her biographers points out, I don't think it's this biographer, but she was often well taken care of throughout her life. I mean, her second husband, whom she lived with for many decades, helped her and give her the space to write. And she never writes about things like that. The women in her fiction are never well taken care of, at least not by men.
Let's compare and contrast it a little bit to the other book you hinted at earlier, which is, I believe, Carol Angier's biography, which was published in the 1980s, 90s?
1985. And it's funny, I went back and read that book in preparation for reading this one. And I was just blown away by just the details in that previous book were so much better than the details in this one. I mean, just line by line and page by page, what people wore, what they ate, where they went. I just felt that the earlier book had this particularity that really worked for me. Seymour's book, I found it slackly written. I found it cruel. There was this great British editor, Diana Athill, who was Rees's editor late in life. And Seymour prints a really, really unflattering photograph of Athill very late in her life. Athill lived to be quite old, and just a horrible picture. And then she writes, this was when she decided I'm paraphrasing. I took this picture when Diana thought finally that I was worth speaking to, giving a little dig. And I don't know, I just book didn't work for me. I do recommend reading about Rees's life. It's a fascinating life, and it's worth knowing about her and her work and how they reflect upon each other.
And I know that a lot of those earlier novels have been reissued in recent years, so people can go and find them, as well as White Sargasso Sea. The Vision of the Sea brings me to you, Alexandra. You wrote this week about a beach book of sorts.
Of sorts, yes. You know, I've railed against this before. I've always thought the idea of the beach read, which I think was coined in the 1990s as a marketing term to sell so-called chick lit, I've always hated the idea of the beach read because the implication is you go to the beach, you leave your brain cells behind, and all you want to read is something very unchallenging and stupid. And to me, this has never made sense because summer, to me, you have time and space, and you know, maybe you can dedicate yourself to something like, you know, The Power Broker. I don't know. That to me would be a good beach read. Anyway, and I also hate read as a noun, but that we can leave that aside for now. Anyway, this was not a beach read in the marketing sense, although it was released, I think, on the first day of summer. But it's a book about our relationship to the beach. Our meaning, people who travel, tourists, vacationers, how the idea of the beach came to mean something wonderful and ideal that we all are supposed to want to spend time at.
So we should say the book is The Last Resort by Sarah Stodola. And it's really about our relationship, right, to this particular version of the beach, which is the resort tourist version, not just the local beach.
Stodola interrogates the idea that the received wisdom that the beach is somewhere we should all want to be. She points out that for many years all over the world, I'm sure there were exceptions, but certainly in the Western world for many, many, many years, the beach was, or the ocean was, considered a source of incredible peril and fear. Nobody thought about sitting around watching it crash on the shore because they were scared. It was uncomfortable. That all changed in America, probably around the turn of the century. She compares it to Goop, actually. There were these doctors who touted the beach as a source of cures. You could wash your eyes with seawater. You could drink it with wine. You could dunk yourself.
Whoa.
Yes.
Rewind. You could drink it with wine. What does that mean?
Well, you mix it, seawater with wine. It makes, Dwight, you should try this.
I'm going to.
It helps the hangover. Yeah.
Seawater and wine. In what proportion?
She didn't provide a recipe, unlike Goop.
To taste.
All right.
Yes. So, you know, it flowed from that, from this idea that the beach was healthy, to it being a site of, as leisure time, I think, in America increased, then the beach became a commercial place.
Then, of course, goes far, far, far beyond the borders of America and becomes a global phenomenon of these beach resorts. And this is where Stadola does a tour of them. And what are her main concerns?
Obviously, climate change is a huge one. I mean, the sea levels are rising. And so many established beaches and cities, you know, notably Miami, or which is founded on beach culture, are disappearing, they're reshaping, they're threat. You know, it's suddenly, again, it goes back to being dangerous because of climate change. So Stadola is very focused on that.
Does the conspicuous consumption bother her?
That didn't seem to bother her quite so much. There are chapters on these fabulous resorts where very wealthy people go. But I think one of the problems I had with the book is that the line between Stadola's indignation and her participation sometimes got a little fuzzy. She had to do a lot of long haul flights to research these resorts. And there's page after page, as I know in the review, there's a lot of ordering of various drinks. You know, there's a margarita here, there's a wine here without seawater. When I think about climate change, I also would want to have a drink. But, you know, the book, it's a little bit maybe undermines the book's seriousness of purpose or this feeling of gravitas about the sand, the shifting sands.
The shifting sands. It sounds like it can wobble a bit between enjoying these places and arguing that maybe we shouldn't go to them anymore.
Yeah, that's right. I felt the argument wasn't quite clear. However, she does provide a very good overview of beach literature, and it's useful for that. And she interrogates things like the all-inclusive vacation and stuff. And I think if you're an average beachgoer and you need your consciousness raised about what you're doing, this is a very good start.
Well, I don't think I'm going to be able to get away this summer, but I'm going to pretend I'm away by drinking seawater and wine in the backyard. That'll be the start.
I can't wait to try that.
That sounds very jolly.
Let's talk about the books you reviewed again.
Mine was I Used to Live Here Once, The Haunted Life of Jean Rhys by Miranda Seymour.
And mine was The Last Resort by Sarah Stadola.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm John Williams.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.